This clip was recorded for the UK Wine Show. For more information about the UK Wine Show, you can go to ukwineshow.co.uk.
Hi, my name's Chris Scott and I'm here with Michelle Brampton, CEO of WSET.
Hi Chris, nice to see you.
Nice to see you again too. We've met a few times now over the last few years.
We have, largely when you're winning awards from memory, right? Educator of the Year type stuff.
Yeah. Got a few of them up there.
I see, yeah. Well displayed.
Well displayed, got to be proud, got to be proud.
You should be.
If you can't big yourself up, then
who can?
No one's going to anyway, are they?
No, very true.
Okay, so you're the CEO of WSET. You took over from Ian Harris. How long ago? About 4 years ago?
3.5 years ago, yeah.
3.5 years ago, yeah. And there's been a lot of changes at WSET over those years.
Yeah.
Changes in direction, changes in attitude, lots of changes. Mm-hmm. So I want to explore some of the things that you've done and some of the things coming down the pipe, so to speak.
Sure.
But one of the things I noticed was when I was doing a little bit of research on you, there's a lot of information, you've done interviews where you've talked about how you landed up in the role at WSET, where you started out as an analyst, then you moved to Treasury Wine Estates, which is a big Australian company, yeah, as an analyst, and then you worked through them until you became the managing director of EMEA, which is European Middle East, I presume,
yes,
Asia.
Yes, Africa, yeah.
And that was your role just before you were poached for WSET.
It was, yes.
Treasury Wine Estates is a big company. You've obviously done very well within the organisation to move through that. But there's nothing about you about where you went to school or what you studied at uni or even that first job. It just said you were working as a consultant of some sort.
Yes,
I was. Where did you go to school? Where did you grow up?
I grew up in Shropshire.
Shropshire?
Yeah, okay. On the Welsh borders.
Yep.
So actually I'm a country girl at heart. Yeah. I went to school in Shropshire. Then I went to university in Leeds, mm-hmm, actually to the Poly in Leeds as it was then, and studied international business with German and did a year in Germany as part of my degree. That's my kind of education. So yeah, very much sort of business and languages focused. I've always liked an international aspect to stuff. Mm-hmm. After that, my first job was at Müller Dairy, the yogurt people. Mm-hmm. So they are German, so that was useful. And I started out in finance from them. I did a year with them and I moved to Sony. So I worked in their consumer and professional division down here in London. I was there for, 4 or 5 years, where I completed my management accounting qualification. So I'm a qualified accountant. Then I did a stint consulting with Arthur Andersen. And then I fell into the wine business, as people say.
Were you there when they collapsed, Arthur Andersen?
They collapsed just after I left, coincidentally. I mean, bizarre coincidence. It was all around the Enron disaster. I left in that spring and it happened that summer.
I applied for a job at Enron years ago, because I'm an electrical engineer and I did a lot of work in the energy trading market. Yeah. And I applied for a job at Enron and I failed the interview. I almost always get the job I apply for, but I failed the Enron one because they made us do a trading test, and the problem was, to do well in the trading test, you literally had to break contracts and just pay penalty fines.
Right.
And that I'm sort of a do-goody, follow the rules type of guy.
Yeah, I'm with you.
So they filtered me out pretty quickly. Yeah, someone who
cannot be manipulated.
Who wasn't dirty enough for them. So
interesting. Good for you, I think, then, in the long run. You and I are here in Southwest London. That's where Treasury Wine Estates are based, in Twickenham.
That's right.
So having had enough of consulting after 3 years, a finance job came up there. And that's how I got into Treasury. I went on a 6-month contract and stayed 19 years. Mm-hmm. Amazing company, brilliant brands, great culture. Really loved it.
And you did some neuro-linguistic programming or NLP?
Yeah, afterwards.
Or was that during Treasury or afterwards?
Afterwards. So I had a 6-month break between Treasury and WSET, and I did my training as a coach with neuro-linguistic programming and neuroscience. I was just really fascinated. I'd had some brilliant coaches, and it's something I wanted to understand and be able to do for other people. Mm. So I did that training in between, and it's useful. How your mind ticks is valuable to know.
Yeah. I don't think I want to know how my mind ticks.
Well, I think if you know how, you can also stop it doing some of the stuff it does. So it's interesting stuff.
Okay.
To me, cool. Anyway.
That coaching, is that an important part of being a CEO at WSET?
Yeah, I think so. Because a huge part of coaching is listening and asking the right questions. So I think that's that is really important, because, you know, I'm not the expert in many of the things that go on at the WSET. I have a team of people that do that. So being able to listen to what they're telling me and understand and ask questions to just sense check it really is really valuable. And one of the first things I did when I arrived at WSET was I actually had half an hour with 60 people, the most senior 60. There's about 180 people that work at WSET. And so I talked to about 60 of them. What's working? What's not working? What do you think the priority is? What would you do first? What do you think about this? And by the end of those 60, you have a kind of clear picture of what's going on. It was classic consulting, really, in some ways. You know, the old adage, the consultant borrows your watch to tell you the time, because people know inherently in the organization, but how you synthesize it into a plan to be able to deliver change. I think that training enabled me to do this job, because I went in thinking, I'm just going to listen and ask questions and figure it out from there. So, yeah, it was useful.
So you came in, what was it, about 2001, during COVID, was it?
WSET, yeah. 2022.
So you came in just at the end of COVID, really.
Yes.
Which was a harrowing experience for a lot of people. Yeah. We had a very good COVID.
I think a lot of people decided, I've got time on my hands, I'm going to learn stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that they did. And it was, but you clearly weren't there during those changes. But one of the things that WSET, in my mind, because I've been an APP now for probably 18 years. I can't remember the exact time when we started, but it's about then. I've always found the organization to be very difficult to work with, because I came from a very freewheeling entrepreneurial type of view. I've always been into new product development and just do things.
Yeah.
And when I hit WST, it was like, oh my goodness me, it's like hitting clay or something. It just slowed right down. But one of the things I was really impressed with them during COVID was some of the things I was trying to get them to do before COVID, they were like, you just couldn't get it through. But as soon as COVID hit, it was like, yeah, off you go.
Yeah.
They were very flexible. And since then, I've noticed a consistent change in the approach from WSET, which is less about being very rigorous and more about values in terms of you can't do this, mm-hmm. and more like, these are the things that you need to understand when you're doing whatever you're going to do.
Yeah, that's intentional. I think there historically a bit of a mindset around how do you regulate for everything that might go wrong? And the reality is you can't do that, and you end up creating a beast of regulation that's unsustainable and not particularly great to work with as a provider. So actually setting out some principles and then managing the exceptions, in my view, is the way to do it. And that's the way I think about people as well. I would rather trust people to do the right thing and then hold them accountable and have the conversation if it goes wrong, rather than just not trust people, because inherently people will generally do the right thing and they know right from wrong. There's always exceptions, but you have to manage those rather than try and manage everything. And I think, you know, the ethos, particularly with providers, is we're in this with you. You know, we're nothing without you, and you're stuck without us. So it should be a partnership approach where we listen to how it is for you and how you operate, and we adapt as much as we can. Obviously, the priority is the integrity of our products and the trust that people have in them. So we're not going to compromise that. But if we can find ways to make it easier for providers to deliver it on our behalf, then yeah, that's absolutely our ethos.
Was Bear something that you inherited, or was it, because WSET launched their Bear qualifications last year.
Yeah.
Was it something you inherited, or was it something that you drove through?
No, it was largely inherited. So the course was largely written when I arrived. What changed was the timing and the strategy of taking it to market. So similar to the regulation within WSET that had become huge, the provision in languages has become huge as well. You know, on the face of it, it looks like we do 13 courses. In reality, there's about 80, because there are so many different languages. Yes. And that's what we're finding with level 3 now, is updating that in 15 languages is, you know, the localization is a year's work on its own. So I think Beer was ready to go in multiple languages. And we had some systems challenges, as you all know, with processing results. We needed to move on to a modern technology platform to be able to speed things up for students and APPs. So we paused the launch of Beer to put the first level one and twos onto Microsoft Dynamics. And then we also just decided to do it in English at that point, because recruiting decent educators, getting APPs set up, doing Beer Ready training, as we called it, is a huge amount of effort and resource. And if we'd been trying to do that in five languages as well, we just couldn't afford to put the resource into it to make it successful. So, yeah, the product itself was largely inherited. How we've brought it to the market was changed.
What are the things that you've done in the last 3.5 years that you're quite proud of in terms of within the WCT?
Yeah. So first of all, I think from a culture perspective, some of the stuff you've just described has changed internally as well as externally. So more trust and empowerment in people, more trying to encourage people to bring ideas and innovation and different ways of doing stuff to the fore. So culturally, it's more inclusive and more empowered, I would say, a different style of leadership from me. And my leadership team, who are, some of them were there before, but there's less of them. So that's been a change at the top as well. And then I guess the big things in terms of impact as well are technology. So now all exams are processed in Microsoft. So as of last week, that's levels 3 and 4 as well. So that's more efficient. And digital certificates is pretty huge. You know, that's had generally really positive feedback. Some people still like a piece of paper, but it's much quicker. It's more environmentally friendly. It's actually more credible in that you can check online that people do really have the qualifications. So we've been doing that. We've done things like set up a customer service team so that APPs have quicker access to information and queries and things that are going on. And then on the product side, we have brought in resource that's really specialized in educational content. So that's new, and you'll have seen it in the recent level 3 spirits that we delivered, that the content is designed by educational instructors. So we have experts in beer, wine, spirits and sake. And historically, they would have created the courses, and they still do in terms of research and curriculum and all that stuff. But we have expertise in making these materials easier for students to use and understand. And that's something that will flow into the level 3 wines for next year as well.
Yeah, I must admit, some people have commented to me who are, because we have people on our courses who are teachers and everything like that. And some of them have said that the course material is not student friendly.
Yeah.
So I think that that's a change in direction that probably will, as it flows through, because it takes years. Some of these courses are out for years and years and years. I think
they take a long time. It takes us 3.5 years to update level 3 wines.
Mm.
And partly, as I said, because of the localization, that's an extra year to do all of those languages as well. So, and that's our biggest, you know, it's the densest course in the most languages, because diploma gets updated every year and is only in English. So that's a bit less of a beast.
Okay. One of the things Ian had, Ian Harris, the previous CEO, was he was very focused on growth. And WCT went from really a very small wine education school to an international school. So he grew the business exceptionally fast for what it was. He did a very good job. When you grow a business so much, there was a lot of, amongst approved program providers, APPs, I'd like to use the word chafe. I mean, there were people who were, there was a lot of approved program providers who really weren't running material courses very often. And so we've just taken on a new person to run level 2. And the first thing she's doing is she's running 4 courses, almost 2 courses a week. And then as soon as she finishes, she's running another 2 courses back to back. So 4 courses over a period of 6 weeks. Just to make sure that she's got what she needs to know down pat, you know. And the only way to get good, I believe, particularly when you're teaching level 3, is just repetition. You've got to do it. And this is a bit different to some other APPs. I don't want my tutors doing too much, because your presentation skills become bored and flat.
Right.
But you've got to do enough that they know the material deeply and they know exactly the problems that students have. So there's a, for me, I'm always struggling to get that balance of making sure they've got enough work that they're really good, but not too much work that they get flat. And, you know, because I've done courses where the presenter's done this course every day.
Bored of their own voice.
Yeah, exactly. And you can't, you know, it's an awful experience, yeah. especially when you're learning something really dense and heavy like that.
Yeah.
But you guys removed, or in the process of removing, a lot of historical APPs who weren't necessarily bigger APPs.
Yeah, and that's about quality for the students and the student experience, exactly as you said. The content might not update that frequently, but if you're not familiar with it and teaching it regularly, then it's not going to be the kind of experience that we want students to have of WSET. So if you're not running a number of courses a year, then yes. And also from our perspective, there's a huge admin burden of keeping a long tail of APPs that are doing a handful of candidates. So yeah, it was about the focus on student experience for us.
Was that your initiative?
Yeah, well, there was already in train the conversation about how do we cut the long tail that's providing poor experience. But it was implemented after I'd started. Yeah, it was a decision to implement it.
And what has that done to the numbers of providers around the world?
Well, interestingly, so we were at about 800. We got down to about 650. And now we're building back up again near to the 750 mark, I think. It fluctuates. We have slightly different cycles for different regions, how we implement these things as well. But yeah, the intent is that it's just better provision, and that there's but it's not that we're just going for lots of big ones. It's just that quality of provision, that there's enough candidates going through on a monthly or annual basis to make it a good experience and make the educators credible, I think, as well.
We launched Bear, and some of the courses we ran for Bear were quite small. Yeah. Not really economically viable, but it was really important for Jamie to just get on that treadmill and just run it regularly so that he has confidence in those courses. And yeah, as an APP, it's, for me, sometimes you run courses where you don't really want to. You might have internal training that you just need to get them in front of people and just get that experience, yeah, and get it, which is always quite tricky. Yeah. I want to touch on something that's in the news everywhere, and that's AI.
Mm-hmm.
AI it's in the process. I think when people talk about the computer revolution, there was no productivity improvement with the computer revolution, really. It wasn't like the washing machine or electricity, light bulb, which had huge productivity growth for humanity. Computers haven't really delivered, but AI has the possibility improving it. You know, we won't need as many lawyers now. It's almost impossible to get a job as a lawyer, which isn't necessarily a bad thing. More lawyers aren't necessarily
a
good thing. But when I attended the AI session at the APP Summit, which was every year you guys get a lot of APPs together, the focus seemed to be on two aspects, really. One was improvement of using AI tools to improve the production of materials.
Yeah.
And also using AI, possibly, although you haven't done it, for assessment and automation.
Yeah.
Do you want to just tease into those two a little bit?
Yeah, so, I mean, actually, we created our own internal AI course to try and upskill everybody to discover opportunities for using it. But the key areas we have been using it are in that production of content and localization already. So that's a big area for AI, the language capabilities. Mm. And then on the assessment side, so one of the things that we're looking for this year will be on-screen testing, particularly for multiple choice, that comes with something called LOFT, linear on-the-fly testing. And those kind of things can be using AI in the background so each student doing a test on screen would have a different exam. And you can be using AI and other technology in the background to either generate questions or choose which questions are being cycled through and who's getting them, so that there's never one exam paper out there. It's beneficial so that you don't run the risk of exam papers being shared in advance, because you never know what you're going to get. There's a bank of questions.
Mm. There's always been a bank of questions, though.
Yeah.
But are you automating it? Because if a paper gets out, I imagine you have to pull all those questions. So it's a very manual process.
Yeah. So I think the longer term plan is to use it for question generation potentially, as well as the cycling of questions as well.
Yeah. Yeah, okay. We've tried that and, it's rubbish.
Oh, really? In what way?
We have flashcards. So we just one period just looking at flashcards and trying to convert them into multi-choice questions.
Mm.
And they're they're not that good. It was not that good.
No,
it wasn't that good.
Well.
Because it was always using things from outside the syllabus and thing. Yeah, it was. And in the end, we found if you're doing a four multi-choice question, you're doing a question with four multi-choices, and you couldn't really think up of a good, you know, you got that fourth one of wrong answer. What is it going to be? You can use AI to generate ideas for it.
Yeah.
But we land up moving away from it and going back to manual processes because we just felt the quality was so much higher with manual.
Interesting. Yeah, it's not something we've tested just yet, but those are kind of discussions that we're having in the background.
You can use it, but you can't use it to write them. Well, in our experience so far.
I think it's a really interesting revision tool. Mm. And I see that with my kids as well. You know, here's my essay, mark it for me, tell me how I could have done better, those kind of things. So I think there's lots of use for students to test and learn with it as well. Mm. Yeah.
Will you be using or looking to use AI to mark the multi-choice questions are easy.
Yeah.
That's easy to answer. But those written questions, and that's the thing that slows down getting results back for
level three
and diploma students as well. Are you looking to use AI for marking purposes?
Not at the moment. The first step will be on-screen marking, which is something we'll be scoping this year as to how that could work so that there's less time involved in getting the papers back, shipping them to markers, getting them back again. I mean, that's what slows it down. So even though we have just moved onto MS Dynamics, that won't speed things up very much because you're right, it's the marking that takes the time. So the next thing will be on-screen marking. I'm sure as things progress with AI, that's something that we'll consider, but not yet.
Yeah.
I think like you said, AI, I read something the other day where somebody said they just sold all their AI stocks. We're in for an AI bomb. Like we had a dot bomb, you know, it's too soon. Businesses are struggling to adopt it fast enough and understand how to use it. It will come like the internet came, but not yet. And I think, you know, we need to make sure everything is rigorous. So in time, maybe.
The other thing is the website. It's getting a refresh, but your website is multi-portal, if you like. There's it does multiple things depending on who you are.
Yeah.
There's a brochure site for students to access information and find an APP or approved program provider. There's a back end for people like myself to get access to materials and all that type of thing. And then there's also London Bridge in that website, which is a competing APP that's buried within your own website. Is the whole thing changing? What's changing? Is it the processes changing? Everything's changing.
Yes.
Check it all out and start again.
Yeah. I mean, it's a really old website, so it needs doing. So yes, it will be everything, the front end. And of course, we've refreshed the brand, so it will look like that. Yeah, it will represent us as the organisation we have become and are becoming, and multi-category for drinks and some of the social impact stuff we do, our ambition around a sustainable and inclusive drinks industry. So yes, it will look and feel different, but it will encompass all of those student APP customers and APP London School content as well.
Yeah. Okay. Does it include process changes, business process changes? For example, about 4 years ago, you tried to go to electronic ordering of exams, and that was dropped because of whatever reason. I'm not sure why. But are you looking to go back to that process?
Not in the first instance. It's something we are looking at and scoping, but I don't think that will be available with the website when we're talking sort of early 2026. Mm-hmm. But absolutely, to allow more self-service and autonomy, that will come just at a later date. So there's the global campus that you access at the moment for information. That will need to be replaced. But in terms of what we're calling a portal for you to be able to do more stuff, we're looking at what's possible for early next year. But I don't know yet the details, but I doubt it will be that all-encompassing.
Okay, and last question. When you look at your six strategic imperatives, which we haven't really covered, but there's a lot of social and cultural objectives in there. And as a drinks category, being social and culturally aware is great. But ultimately, the World Health Organization and the prohibitionists are coming out and saying things all the time.
Yeah.
And I personally think it's like anything, you know, drinks go through cycle. Whenever there's a recession, people drink less because they haven't got any money and they get on their high horse, and then they go boom and everybody's drinking champagne. You know, so I'm not I don't worry about it too much.
Yeah.
But how do you square that circle of a lot of health organizations are saying alcohol's bad, you're going to die forever, versus your social, cultural positioning?
Well, for me personally, I think I'm in the camp that alcoholic beverages have a long cultural history and in moderation are part of the fabric of society, I think. And, the whole theory on the J curve that small amounts, because they are part of social settings, actually lead to a longer, healthier life.
Yeah.
I personally buy into that. As WSET, there's always content in the books about the harms of drinking and why it's moderated. And my belief is with students, the more you understand, the more discerning you are about what you consume and therefore likely to drink in moderation anyway, is my thought on it. If you're out to get drunk, you're less likely to have understood lots of the intricacies that you learn from our courses. But and that's just my view. Who knows? People drink for lots of different reasons. So, I can't really comment on that.
What's your favourite tipple?
Oh, God, I don't have one. I mean, I would say champagne as a go-to, but I really love a Negroni. I love a Weissbier. The list could go on.
Yeah.
Okay. Depends on the occasion and the company, I would say.
Yes. Yeah. Yes, fair enough as well. All right then, Michelle, I think we'll wrap it up there. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me, Chris.